All right, welcome back. Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Before we get started, a little side note. So in case you haven't noticed, Questioning Medicine itself has been going through a little bit of a crisis, if you will, over the last year and a half to 2 years. Joe, gone, no longer. It's just the humble host myself. It's just me running the show, and I've kind of struggled. I've went from residency to attending ship, and when you're in attending ship, I still do deep dives like I used to do in residency all the time. I mean, I do them almost at least once or twice a week. And it's not the deep dive that's difficult. It's the turning it into a podcast. It's then trying to put all that into words to convince you, the listener, that, listen, I know I'm talking about, this is the right thing to do. And so I want to keep Questioning Medicine around. I want to keep it going, but I've struggled. How do I do that? Do I just do interviews? Do I go back to doing deep dives and actually try to convince everyone? What do I do? So I'm going to try something out. For the next 3 months, I'm going to release one podcast every 10 days to 2 weeks. But instead of being deep dives, they will just be a little bit shorter, maybe 15 minutes or so, and it's going to be whatever I'm reading about is what I'm talking about. Whatever I'm thinking about is what I'm talking about. Whatever kind of medicine's going on currently or recent practices or updates that I think need to be said is going to go on. I might cover 12 different topics in one episode, but I promise they're all going to be supported by the literature. They're all going to have papers next to them. I'll usually cite the papers, and if you want the papers, as always, I'll be more than happy to send any of those out. You can just email me or reach me on Twitter at AndrewBilt or AndrewBilt@gmail.com. Now that that is out of the way, 3 months from now will be the stop date of this. So it is February 1st. We're doing February, March, and April. May 1st, I'll stop, reevaluate, and say, is this working? Is this not working? But I need you, the listener, to tell me, do you like this format? Do you not like this format? Or do you think that this is pretty lame? Tell me what's up. Tell me what's going on. Email me. Reach out to me on Twitter. Without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, and any further procrastination, Questioning Medicine 2018, here we go. Talking about what I'm reading about, getting into what I'm getting into. And first up, I got to ask the question out there. The question is super obvious. They say money can't buy happiness, but maybe the question is, can it buy happiness? You see, we don't know, but what we do know is from a paper in JAMA Internal Medicine 2017, October 30th, titled Effect of Patient Navigation and Financial Incentives on Smoking Cessation, that money can buy you smoking cessation. How much money does it take for a patient to quit smoking? Well, the magical answer seems to be about $750 if you stop smoking for 12 months. This was 350 low-income adults. The annual household income was less than $20,000. The participants had to smoke 10 cigarettes or more daily and at least be in the contemplation stages of quitting smoking. They were giving $250 if they had stopped smoking at 6 months, and then an additional $500 if they had stopped smoking at 12 months. So that's a total of $750. And they assess whether you actually quit smoking or not by doing biochemical saliva test or urinary analysis. Now, at 12 months, those in the intervention group, those that were randomized to, hey, we'll give you this money if you quit smoking, 12% in the intervention group had stopped smoking. As compared to the control group, and the control group was just a, hey, you should stop smoking, it's not good for you, please stop. Only 2% in the control group had stopped smoking. If you put those together, that's a number needed to treat of 10. 10 for offering them $750 to quit smoking. That's similar to the numbers for medications for smoking cessation, those like bupropion or varenicline. Again, money can't buy happiness, but it can buy you to quit smoking, which is the age-old statement of, you couldn't pay me enough money to do that. They probably could pay you enough money to do that. Most people just don't have enough money to pay you to do that. But everything comes with a price, and it appears for at least one in every 10 people that are in low-income housing, about $750 a year is enough to quit smoking. All right, that's the first order of business. Now let's go to two quick hitting pieces in my stacks of literature, if you will. First of all, pain, chronic pain. We know it is a problem. We know that opiates, giving out opiates is a problem, and people are going to want different solutions. Back pain seems to be one of the number one causes of chronic pain or even really acute pain. Again, opiates we know are not the solution long term, and a lot of people don't want to give NSAIDs long term because of the complications that come with that, such as the GI side effects. So some people are going to be asking for lidocaine patches. The 5% lidocaine patches, they cost about $7 to $9 a patch on GoodRx per my location down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. But here's a little tip, here's a little sidebar, here's a little something for you. First of all, lidocaine patches, as far as I could find, no real good evidence on them being used in low back pain. But if you're going to try it, you're going to write for a prescription for it, and it's 5%, and they're willing to pay the $7, $8 to try it, consider telling them to go to the over-the-counter patches, Lidocare 4%, the Icy Hot 4%, lidocaine plus menthol patches. You can even get the Walmart brand patches. Again, I don't really care what patches they get. I'm not paid by any of them. I don't care. But those patches only cost $2 or so a patch. And again, those are 4% lidocaine. Is the 1%, is the difference between the 4% and the 5% really that big of a deal? The answer is likely no. In fact, the answer is almost certainly no. If we ever did a randomized controlled trial on this, double-blinded, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between 4% and 5%. We're saving, it's significantly cheaper. I mean, with the actual prescription costing almost 400%, relative terms, obviously, more than the over-the-counter, just tell your patient to get over-the-counter. All right, enough with that. If you go back to one of the very first episodes, I don't even know if it's up anymore. I should go look. We talk about K-Exalate and my love and hate for K-Exalate, how it was done before the Cleaver-Busey Act, which said that all drugs had to be safe and effective. So it never had to prove that it had to be safe and effective. And the K-Exalate likely doesn't really work as well as we want it to. I think the bottom line, no matter what you think about K-Exalate, and if you've read the evidence on it, you know it's not great. The bottom line is the patient peeing. If they're peeing, their potassium is going to come down. If they're not peeing, why are they not peeing? And when can we get them dialysis? Because if they're not peeing, eventually they're going to need dialysis anyways. So what are you going to do with a high potassium? I guess it depends on how high the potassium is before we say anything. But giving K-Exalate or any of these potassium binding substances really isn't probably doing much. It's a drop in the ocean, if you will. However, FDA came out with a new label, a new statement warning to space out the treatments, space out giving these K-binding substances by 3 hours due to the safety data, meaning 3 hours before, don't give any other medication. 3 hours after, don't give any other medication because the potassium binding molecule or compounds will bind up other molecules such as medications, and then it won't be nearly as effective. It's important to know about, but again, I think the real question becomes, what do you do with hyperkalemia? Are they peeing? Are they not peeing? If they're peeing, great. If they're not peeing, let's get a nephrologist. Let's get dialysis going. That's the bottom line. Up next, as I'm sure you've all heard, there are new hypertension guidelines out there, and it's a long document. In fact, it's a really long document. It's like 192 pages to be precise, and some of the document is actually pretty good. It talks about the DASH diet, it talks about exercise, it talks about getting more than one blood pressure, talks about starting patients on more than one medication. When you do start them on medications that, really we can go with any set of different medications, never start with a beta blocker, but hydrochlorothiazide or calcium channel blocker, a diuretic, an ACE inhibitor, an ARB, they're all the same really universally. So I really do like it in that sense. However, with every up comes a down, with every in comes an out, with every good comes a bad. And this one is really no different. In JAMA Internal Medicine 2017, November 13th, and this paper was Association of Blood Pressure Lowering with Mortality, that's a good outcome, and Cardiovascular Disease Across Blood pressure levels, a systematic review, and meta-analysis. The thing that's interesting is that this was released at almost the exact same time as the blood pressure guidelines. Here's what it said. It had the researchers do an analysis on 74 pretty much industry-funded randomized trial. The analysis involved just over 300,000 participants and 1.2 million person years of follow-up. That's a lot of follow-up. Two-thirds of the trials were classified as primary prevention. Primary prevention meaning that less than 50% of the participants had known cardiovascular disease. This is good or bad. Two-thirds, so a large majority had no previous heart attack, no previous stroke, no previous cardiovascular disease. They were the typical patient that comes in with hypertension. And I think that this is reasonable because this is typically what we see. I mean, a majority of the patients that come into a primary care setting actually haven't had a heart attack, haven't had a stroke before, but they do have high blood pressure and maybe a few other comorbid conditions, but they are definitely still primary prevention. All right, so for primary prevention, I'm going to try to follow the numbers here. If you had a baseline systolic blood pressure of 140 to 159, so this is significantly above the new 130 treatment, it was associated, if you were treated, with a relative risk reduction of 13% for all-cause death and 12% for adverse cardiovascular events. The cardiovascular events was a composite outcome of mortality, major cardiovascular events, coronary heart disease, stroke, heart failure, and end-stage renal disease. Now, if you had a blood pressure and you were primary prevention, but you had a blood pressure of a systolic blood pressure over 160, and you were treated or given blood pressure medication, so again, over 160, and you were treated with blood pressure medications, a 7% relative risk reduction in all-cause death, and a 22%, a whopping almost double reduction in adverse cardiovascular events. However, this is the big but, the big but. Treatment did not lower the risk for either all-cause death or adverse cardiovascular events when the baseline systolic blood pressures were less than 140. But that was only for primary prevention. If this was secondary prevention, it was associated with a lower risk for major adverse cardiovascular events, but not all-cause or cardiovascular-related death. So we're just talking heart attacks and stroke here. I think the big thing here is, and I'm just going to weigh in on my two cents, is that is this primary prevention? Is this secondary prevention? Let's be honest. The guidelines before said, let's treat to 140, and almost everyone was getting to 142 or 145 or maybe just under 140. Now if we say 130, realistically, most people are not going to end up treating to under 130. So it's probably just going to end up in the same range that the previous guidelines recommended. The AFP, American Academy of Family Physicians, has come out and said, we do not support these. These are not our guidelines. We did not tie our names to these. So if you're a family physician, don't worry about that. Take it as you will. Take it as you wish. I think overall, the real thing here is that hypertension is not hypertension. It depends on, is it primary? Is it secondary prevention? What other comorbid conditions do they have? It's just like diabetes is not diabetes. If you have diabetes, but A1C of 6.6, that's a lot different than diabetes of a hemoglobin of 10. And I think we know that by now. So that's my two cents. Take from it what you will. I'd love to hear what you're doing. Reach out to me again on Twitter at Andrew Bilt or email me, andrewbilt@gmail.com. All right, this podcast is almost wrapping up to the end, and I hope it's not too painful. Speaking of painful, the paper I'm referring to was titled Effect of a Single Dose of Oral Opioid and Non-Opioid Analgesics on Acute Extremity Pain in the Emergency Department. This was in JAMA 2017, back in November, and here's what they did. They looked at 411 adult emergency department patients that came in with acute extremity pain. The four regimens that you could be randomized to were either ibuprofen, 400 milligrams, plus acetaminophen, 1,000 milligrams. Oxycodone, 5 milligrams, plus acetaminophen, 325. Hydrocodone, 5 milligrams, plus acetaminophen, 300 milligrams. and codeine 30 milligrams plus acetaminophen 300 milligrams. The pain then was measured on an 11-point scale, and they asked your pain before they gave you the medication, and they asked you the pain again 2 hours after giving you the medication. They asked before giving the medication, and I'm surprised it wasn't a 12. It seems like every time I walk into the room, the patient always says, oh, doc, it's at least a 12, 13, 14. I'm thinking that's not even possible. You're eating McDonald's. But the pain was 8.7. 2 hours after, they said, how's your pain now? How you feeling? And there was no statistically significant differences in pain reductions between the different treatment groups, with the reduction scales lowering about 4 points. So you went from about an 8.7 average out of an 11-point scale down to what would be a 4.7 or a 5. Again, pretty good. I think the important thing here is I don't necessarily understand or don't necessarily like. They gave 1,000 milligrams of acetaminophen with ibuprofen, but only 325 when they gave hydrocodone or oxycodone. Now, at first, I thought to myself, well, wait a second. I mean, that makes sense because ibuprofen isn't as strong as hydrocodone or oxycodone. So, yeah, we should give more Tylenol. And then this is great because this is in an opiate crisis world when none of us really want to give out opiates. We know that this really is not that effective of a drug for really just about anything other than maybe an acute fracture or something of that sense, cancer pain. You know, I'm not against it there, but this makes sense. And then I kept reading, and then I kept learning, and then I kept going on. And it goes back to a title also in JAMA, all the way back to 2015, titled Naproxen with Cyclobenzaprine, Oxycodone, Acetaminophen, or Placebo for Treating Acute Low Back Pain, a randomized clinical trial. And these were patients that came in with non-traumatic, non-radicular low back pain of 2 weeks duration or less. This is the acute back pain that we see all the time. The patients were given 20 tablets of naproxen, 500 milligrams, to be taken twice a day. They were then, you were randomized to receive either 60 tablets of placebo, 60 tablets of cyclobenzaprine, or oxycodone, 5 milligrams, acetaminophen, 325. The patients then were instructed to take the one or two of these tablets every 8 hours as needed for low back pain. The outcome that they were looking for was how was your improvement on your functional improvement 1 week after discharge. Now remember, some people just got basically Motrin with placebo. They thought, you know, maybe they were getting oxycodone, but they really just got placebo. You would think the people that got placebo would be not doing so well. Their functional score, if you will, would not be nearly as good. However, there was no statistical difference between them. Nope, not one. Didn't matter if you got placebo, didn't matter what you got. But then, as I kept reading, as I kept learning, as I kept coming across more papers, here we go, Annals of Emergency Medicine, 2013, October 13th, acetaminophen or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs in acute musculoskeletal trauma, a multi-center, double-blind, randomized clinical trial. This looked at right about 550 adults with acute blunt minor musculoskeletal extremity trauma. They were randomly assigned, here we go, to acetaminophen, so Tylenol, 4,000 milligrams a day, diclofenac, Motrin, 150 milligrams per day, or acetaminophen, 4,000 milligrams a day, plus diclofenac, 150 milligrams a day. The primary outcome measured was between the group differences in the mean numeric rating scale, or the pain scale in rest and with movement at 90 minutes after the initial drug administration, meaning you're in pain. What's your pain scale? Okay, it's this number. I'm going to give you the medication. Let me come back in 90 minutes and then I'm going to ask you again and say, what is it? We're trying to see, is that number different? One would think, as we already know, diclofenac, Motrin, is a pretty good drug. We know that NSAID plus acetaminophen was no different or no statistical difference with oxycodone and hydrocodone. So now we go to this one and I'm thinking to myself, wait a second. So this one we have Tylenol by itself, we have an NSAID by itself, and then we have an NSAID with Tylenol by itself. Let's see here. Well, wouldn't you know it? Pain treatment with just Tylenol alone, 4,000 milligrams a day, was not inferior to that with diclofenac or the combination of acetaminophen and diclofenac in acute minor musculoskeletal extremity trauma, end quote. And there we go. That is a mic drop. And if you didn't follow it, I'm going to say it one more time real closely and as briefly or as concise as I can. Here's the deal. We know that Motrin or an NSAID by itself with placebo beat Motrin plus oxycodone for musculoskeletal pain. We know that for musculoskeletal pain, 4,000 milligrams of Tylenol was not inferior for naproxen or Motrin or an NSAID, if you will. And again, I think all the NSAIDs are roughly about the same. We could get into that different debate later, but they're roughly the same. So if the NSAID beat the opioid, or it was no different than the opioid, and Tylenol was no different than the NSAID, then one would have to say that for at least roughly speaking, Tylenol for musculoskeletal pain is roughly equal to the opioid. I know that's hard to wrap your head around, which brings me back to this original article titled Effect of a Single Dose of Oral Opioids and Non-Opioid Analgesic on Acute Extremity Pain. Here's the bottom line. Why did they not use 1,000 milligrams of acetaminophen, as we know, or 4,000 milligrams of acetaminophen per day? As we know from a couple trials now, this seems to be a pretty solid treatment for pain, for musculoskeletal pain. I don't think that most of us are probably dosing it high enough. I know that I was not dosing it high enough. Now, honestly, I think I shouldn't have to say this, but I'm going to. Don't stay on that dose forever. That wouldn't be wise. But if you're on it for just a short term, I think it's probably reasonable and probably a decent muscle pain analgesic. But again, however you take it, the real overwhelming thing here is this adds to the growing support, the growing literature, if you will, that oral opioids are not nearly as helpful as we once thought they were. I know it's one of the quick things to reach for, but really, maxing out the Tylenol, maxing out the NSAID will probably get us equal bang for the buck, and maybe, just maybe, 1 gram of acetaminophen every 6 hours will work for a large majority of patients with musculoskeletal pain. All right, this podcast has already went a little bit too long, a little bit longer than what I like. But again, I'm going to put these out at least every 10 days to 2 weeks. And so until next time, I'm going to end this podcast like I've ended every podcast before it. Keep the quest in questioning.